Menards is the ultimate home improvement destination in the Midwest. Since 1958, we've been supplying you with everything from hardware to automotive needs. We believe in helping you save big money on every project, big or small. From top-of-the-line tools to plumbing supplies, paint, and appliances, we've got you covered. We thank you for making Menards a part of your year. From our family to yours, have a safe and happy new year.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today, delighted to be joined by Vicky Lahn of the Speculative Sandbox podcast. It's a fantastic show, which sees Vicky joined by a fantastic array of guests to unpack a fantasy trope or a sci-fi trope, such as dystopian governments, parallel universes, ghost therapies, and interplanetary travel. You can listen to it on pretty much every podcast streaming platform, and do check out Vicky's website, which has loads of really great resources on it too. So in our chat, Vicky and I talk about specifically the epic quest trope and how you can look for inspiration in our real world to breathe new life into them and find original angles. We also talk about other tropes like resurrections and mentor figures. I also share the results of a poll I did quite a while ago now, a couple of years, which looked at the most hated fantasy tropes. And that might give you some ideas on what to avoid. We also talk about some great examples of authors who have twisted classic fantasy tropes or found new and original angles, like Nicholas Eames in Kings of the Wild and a little bit of George R. R. Martin as well. Before we dive into that chat, I just wanted to wish you a very happy festive period. I hope it's been peaceful with lots of time spent with the people you love, the people that matter. And if you're banging into your writing, I hope you get a nice bit of time to yourself to do a bit of writing and make some progress on your stories. It's been a fantastic year for the podcast. I'm hugely grateful to everyone who listens to the show. It really does mean an awful lot. And to hear from you guys, letting me know that what we're doing with this podcast is helping you and encouraging you and inspiring you, that's what keeps us going. So as long as we keep helping and you keep listening, we'll carry on doing it. And we've got a really exciting year ahead to look forward to. We've got a new blown partnership with some top publishers, like a new robot. We've got an interview lined up next January with the brilliant author Stephen Orion. So, fingers crossed, you'll be seeing that one soon. And we'll just continue to bring on specialists and experts in all different fields that will hopefully give you knowledge, inspiration and ideas for your stories. And as long as it keeps helping you, we'll keep on doing it. So if you don't want to miss any episodes, be sure to follow or subscribe. If you really like these episodes and the show, please give us a quick rating on the Spotify mobile app or on iTunes. And if you know of anyone who may be interested, a quick share goes a long way, and we really do appreciate that. So thank you very much if you do share this on social media or with anyone you think may enjoy the show. And if you want to get involved with our growing writing community, check out the link in the description. We've got about 250 odd people in our Discord group at the moment, and we've just launched our first wave of critique groups. So these writers, there's about 30 in total. So we split them into groups of five. So there's about seven or eight groups. And everyone's partnered up based on the genres that they write, how often they want to meet, time zones for logistical purposes. And now there's all these groups forming in our writing community. So if you want to join an online writing group, everyone is helping each other achieve their goals, then check out the link in the description to join the writing community and get onto the Discord server, because it's really blowing up at the moment, so I'm amazed how it how much it keeps taking off. Now it's time to dive into this brilliant and fascinating chat with Vicky Lan as we deconstruct a bunch of classic fantasy tropes. I'm thrilled to welcome to the Toolshed today, for the very first time, Vicky Lan of the Speculative Sandbox podcast. Vicky, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, nice. Thank you very much for being here. Vicky, your podcast is all about deconstructing tropes that are found in sci-fi, fantasy, and supernatural fiction. Examples include dragons and zombie outbreaks. And I noticed that you do cover quite a few world-building related topics as well. And overall, from what I've listened to so far, it's a truly excellent podcast, really informative, learn loads, and got lots of great reviews. And there's already loads of episodes out on there already. So, I mean, how have you found the whole podcasting business?
Oh, well, thank you, first of all. I really appreciate that. Podcasting was really interesting because I started it when I was in a writing slump and I realized I needed a community to just talk ideas. You know, think about like a writer's circle or club where you get together and you workshop, hey, I've got this idea I'm working on. And then they come up with a brilliant idea and then you take that home with you and you write it down. And that same exact energy is what I wanted to create in a podcast. So I had some friends, luckily, on Twitter, on writing Twitter, who were willing to kind of take a risk with me on the first couple episodes. And we just had fun with it and it just kind of took off from there. So I feel very lucky and fortunate to have this community.
Yeah, it is a fantastic community, the podcasting one. The only reason I keep doing it is because people listen to it and keep emailing and asking for certain topics and stuff like that. So it's very much community driven and it sounds like you're enjoying that the same thing with your one.
Yeah, absolutely. There's great creative energy to talk to people and people have such great ideas. I was looking over this season's materials and I'm just so thankful to be able to talk to some of the guests that I had because they're just amazing and they took the time to share that with me and our listeners. So it's great.
Yeah, awesome. And the reason why I wanted to have a chat with you for the show is because you do specialize in workshopping tropes and it's not something that we've spoken an awful lot about. It is something that I have touched about on my website. And one time I did do a poll of a good few hundred readers and shared the results on my blog, which I'll ask you about later. Because when we were chatting before organizing the chat today, we both kind of fell upon a particular trope, which I've been thinking an awful lot about recently. And that is taking classic epic fantasy quests and giving them a modern spin or applying modern or real world challenges to the epic fantasy world. So rather than setting off on a voyage to rescue a princess, our characters might instead embark upon a quest to take out an unhinged dictator, with, you know, like a bit like Putin. So yeah. It's like, I try and think an awful lot, like in Pariah's Lament, I did include like the two main leaders of the War of Nations were basically just like feuding amongst themselves. And that is like a real digger, mm-hmm. what modern day warfare is like. It's just individuals making these decisions that are affecting thousands and thousands of people. So to kick things off, I thought it'd be a good starting point to understand what that quest trope is.
Yeah. So the epic quest, when you're looking at just a traditional standard epic quest, you have a place of origin and you have a reason for leaving that place. So think Frodo and his band of friends leaving the Shire to ultimately get to Mount Doom. Usually there's a collection of characters and they have a goal. Save a princess, slay a dragon. I also think of the video game Legend of Zelda. That's a really good epic quest. And it's not always just about the end goal. It's also about the points along the way and the lessons you learn there. So when they are in the Dark Forest or when they're spending some time with the elves in Lord of the Rings, those are also the point of the epic quest. And for readers that are getting into it, that are maybe expecting, okay, how do we get to the end goal? And they're wondering, why do we keep making stops? Well, that's the point of the epic quest, is that growth over time.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important parts of it, isn't it? It's not a series of grand plot points. It's a character growing, or characters growing, as they sort of they're faced with massive challenges that they would never have encountered if they'd have stayed exactly where they were in that sort of origin point, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
What are your favorite examples of classic epic quests?
Well, I was trying to think of examples of epic quests that I really enjoy. One that I have to recommend is called Kings of the Wild by Nicholas Eames, I think is how you say his name. Excellent. Kings of the Wild, W-Y-L-D is how you spell wild.
Yeah, it's a great, it's a fantastic book for many reasons, but go on.
It's so, okay, I have to totally geek out over it though, because not only is this following the same epic quest template, but they have done something amazing about like medieval fighting. They have equated it to band culture. So you have this band of fighters. They're literally like all these synonyms and allegories for musician bands. So you got your weapon, which is your guitar, and they have gigs, which is when they get hired to go kill a troll or whatever. And then they battle it out in an arena, just like a concert. It is so cool. And not only that, incredibly humorous, wonderful characters. It made me laugh. It made me cry. Highly recommend that story.
Yeah, it is a fantastic book. It does. It's sort of, the quest is quite simple, I think. It's just like one character's daughter is in trouble. And these guys, this band, they were like the Kings of the Wild. They were legends, but they're all a bit old now. And which is another brilliant twist, I thought, because most of the time we've got these young whippersnappers, you know what I mean, going out on quests. And instead we've got the sort of the aging generation. Yes. So that was good. But like you say, it's the way it was done, I think, brought a lot of originality to that trope, do you think?
I think so, absolutely. Because I think what happens too is there's, in America at least, the rock of like the 80s, it's kind of a dying out genre. And we have a lot of pop and, you know, processed kind of, you can tell that money has kind of taken over the productions of music. And so when you have like the Metallicas of the world, like it's very indicative of that time frame. And so you have the people from that time frame are kind of, they're aging and they can relate to the characters in the story. I have a coworker and another podcast guest that I had, Brad Alice. He loves metal. And as I'm reading this book, I keep texting him. I'm like, you have to read this. I don't think you understand. Like, this book will speak to like a lot of your experiences and passions. And I share it with as many people as I can.
I completely agree. Have you got any other examples that you've found have really sort of spun the classic trope?
I think an interesting interpretation of an epic fantasy epic quest, which might not be very fantastical, but kind of is Forrest Gump, because the movie from the 90s, I believe, the movie isn't about where he ends up in the end. Like, they kind of establish the stakes, you know, Jenny and his love, and eventually they end up together, but then they don't even have a lasting relationship, right? She dies because she has AIDS, I believe. But it's about the journey along the way and the character building and all the people that he meets. He goes to the Vietnam War. He works on a boat, and it is technically fantastical if you think about the span of impact that he has and the famous people that he meets, like the fact that Elvis is inspired by him, I believe, at one point. That is an interesting way. If you really think about it, it's an epic journey.
In that example, like Forrest Gump, he doesn't really change much as a character. He's quite static and all of that, which is interesting in itself, because most people, as they sort of go through these things, like if you go to the Vietnam War, most people, well, a lot of people anyway, came back with psychological disorders through the horrors that they'd witnessed there. In looking at Forrest Gump, he was just sort of someone, it was like water off the duck's back.
Yeah.
And that's interesting in itself, and twisting a bit of a trope. But again, I think, I don't know, it depends on what you like, isn't it? Because I'm really enjoying this new wave of modern fantasy where characters are suffering from mental health problems, like hacking someone's head off with a sword, there is repercussions to that on a psychological level. It's not just something that you just do and then job done, off you go. Like, because then battlefields would have been horrific. We do cover quite a lot of history on the show, medieval history in particular. So some of the things we've heard, like, it's craziness.
Yeah. And I'm glad that they're introducing that, because I had another guest that talked about the importance of mental health and the impacts of that. I think Brandon Sanderson, I believe, touches on that.
Yeah.
And it's refreshing, because I don't know if you've read Game of Thrones. I feel like there isn't that in Game of Thrones. I think they show impacts of war and violence, but I feel like there's a lot of, like, leaning into violence, and it's like a celebration of violence if you kind of look at Game of Thrones from a very overarching standpoint. And it's nice to be able to kind of, like, hey, no, this actually has a lasting effect. It's not just chess on a chessboard, it's people, and it messes with your brain.
Yeah, most definitely. I think to get the most out of, like, an epic fantasy story, and you've got that quest in mind. And we were talking at the beginning about characters going on these journeys, and it's that emotional journey, I think, which is so important. So it's what is going to keep a reader sticking with the story for 150,000 words. Because if there's no emotional attachments to the characters and stuff, like, the characters are flat and static.
Mm-hmm.
What's the point? What's the point?
I've read stories where, like, I could feel like, all right, location one, location two, location three, and I'm just, like, moving through the paces at that point. And it's really important to have opposing forces kind of blanketing those plot points, so it doesn't feel so predicted.
Yeah. Have you encountered any useful techniques for achieving that in your writing?
I certainly work on character development. I don't think I have any epic quest formatting yet, but I do, in general, really like to play with reader expectations. I get a lot of inspiration from Jason Pargin, who wrote John Dies at the End, where a sentence starts and you're not sure how it's going to end, or really playing with people for your chapter cliffhangers and your chapter starts. I really enjoy doing that, because it's playful, it's almost theatrical, and that kind of re-energizes people as they kind of start a new chapter. And, you know, kind of rather than feeling like you're slogging along, it's like, oh, that's interesting, and inspires them to keep reading. So that's probably the closest. I don't write epics, but that's probably the way I like to keep momentum going.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And do you focus a lot on the key characters' emotions when you are looking at character developments and the conflict and the plots of the story?
Yes. So my stories, we're currently shopping, one of my manuscripts right now, is own voice. So there's an added focus of diversity and perspective. And so for me, it's about honesty, but also, because this is probably a reflection of me as well, I like to be, like, comedically candid about awkwardness. Yeah. I think a lot of people want to present their best foot forward and look like the badass, you know, hero. But I'm like, I fully embrace that my characters are like, I don't know what's going on. This is ridiculous and weird, but I am 100%. It's more about, like, how do they overcome these challenges? Because in everyday life, we overcome something that's unusual or not clear to us. Think of, like, a new job that you start, or if you're dealing with, like, a new medical condition and you're facing a whole new world. Like, these are all relatable things. Yeah. I just like that candidness.
Yeah. Yeah, me too, completely. I think when you're writing first drafts as well, you can kind of, there's so much to think about. You kind of gloss over certain aspects of character, the developments, and, like, that kind of emotional reaction to things that happen in the story. And something I developed to try and make sure that I never miss it is, I call it character plotting. So what I basically do is draw a graph, like an X and Y axis, and it's just a line graph. So I'll just draw little dots on the graph about, which represent the sort of the points of conflict, I call them. So basically what happens, and then based on how the character reacts or the outcome of that, with the character's interaction with that source of conflict, it's either a positive or a negative response. And then if it's positive, then I'll plot it high on the graph. And if it's negative, I'll plot it low. And then you draw a line in from your next point of conflict. And then if that's positive, and then you, all of a sudden you see these sort of highs and lows, the ebbs and flows of this character's emotional journey as they are engaging with all these different points of conflict. So I always do that now whenever I'm writing anything. And it basically, when I've got a visual overview of that emotional reaction, and it's that emotional reaction, I think, that makes the character real and engaging to follow. So yeah, that helps me an awful lot. I'll put a link in the description if anyone wants to check it out.
It's great too, because you're essentially creating rules, which then lead to a fundamentals of your character. So if you know that your character is going to react adversely or positively to certain reactions, then you can start to get an idea of like, what is their fundamental belief system? And then they feel a lot more grounded.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll just go back to that epic quest trope, like we're saying. One thing that we mentioned at the start, and something I always try and do, is how are we putting that sort of modern spin on it? And one thing I wanted to ask you about is the types of inspiration that you could sort of look for when it comes to putting that modern contemporary spin on things.
I had some fun with this one because I was like, all right, you can always get examples of modern epic quests in like any road trip movie. But like, I really wanted to think about, okay, what, like, I haven't seen a road trip movie in a really long time. So I'm like, okay, I need to get myself updated on pop culture. Like, what is prevalent in today's world? And so I started thinking about what are the motives for people for leaving, and then what would they encounter along the way? And what they could encounter along the way just seemed easier. So I tackled that first. And so in my opinion, I was trying to reflect off of what could you expect to see in today's culture. And so I'm going off of, I live in Arizona. So I'm going off of the wide expanse of the USA, and thoughts that came across to me was coming across political rallies, women's marches, finding a group of influencers out in the wild, which I thought would be really comedic, like almost like in Shakespeare, you have the clown characters, you know, coming across like people with huge personalities and they look really silly, but they've got a lot of courage because they're doing that out in the wild, and learning from them. Then I wanted to incorporate a location that talks about an actual genuine concern that we as a society deal with. And the easiest one I could think of was Airbnb rentals. This would replace the tavern in the epic fantasy. Yeah. But there are some nefarious things about Airbnbs that people have been concerned about, like hosts setting up cameras, or maybe you witness a murder. I'm not saying this happens at all establishments. Yeah. I'm sure there's very trustworthy establishments, but there's been enough concerns where people have been worried about using Airbnb. Same goes for Uber transportation services. So things like that. I also came up with, you know, public events that mean something about the culture. Here in Arizona, we have Dia de los Muertos, which is the Day of the Dead. Really cool to, you know, stumble upon something like that. And then finally, the absurdities of technology, which is, I think, what makes now interesting and unique to like past epics, where you rely on all this tech to get you on the road and going, but then your technology fails you in some way. Maybe your smart card dies. Or if this is a sci-fi epic, you're trapped in a smart car and you're going wherever your smart car is programmed to go against your will.
Yeah.
And so now we've inverted you've chosen to go on an epic. Now you're like forced into a journey. And what does that mean for your story?
Yeah. And like you say, there has to be a compelling reason for them to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I sort of found a bit of inspiration for in my current work in progress. And I started writing it in the height of the migrant crisis.
Okay.
And especially in Europe. I mean, the US, like on the border, there was like big surge in migrants moving up from Latin America, wasn't it? And other sort of more southern North American states to the US border when Trump was in power. And in Europe, we had a massive migration from the Middle East into Europe, and lots of people trying to cross the channel from France to England. And they were just taking like the craziest risks, like with the whole family, like kids.
Wow. Yeah.
the whole family, and like whole families were just being wiped out and like found washed up on beaches. And yeah. It was a really like moving picture of just a small child, maybe two or three years old, like just like drowned on the beach. Mm-hmm. And it, like thing when you see that, you do obviously think about being in their situation and considering the risk and reward of what they're trying to do. It's really powerful and emotive. So I tried to encapsulate that in the character that I've created. And she's living in a war-torn country. And it's humans fighting orcs. It's, well, my own version of orcs, not like the typical Lord of the Rings mm-hmm. orcs. And the husband's being killed in the war. He was conscripted. And she's on her own. And the orcs have finally arrived at her village. And she's like prepared to leave. But she just needed that final push because she was reluctant. It's not only has she got orcs to contend with, like this war's been going on for a year and humanity has fallen apart. And that's what I wanted it to be like. I just wanted it, like, when I'm always thinking about creating conflict in a story, I just want this character to go through absolute hell. The life has got to be nothing but misery until he gets to the end. That's what I try and achieve with plotting stuff out. And obviously the emotional journey is incredibly important, because if a character's constantly being battered with challenges, like psychological challenges, then you need to really dig into that emotional reaction. And I think that's where you can find the originality in your epic fantasy quests.
Mm-hmm. Well, your symbolism, your version of orcs being like the invading force that the main characters now have to get away from is a great gateway for people to develop empathy for real world people that are running from things. And sometimes it's kind of sad that you have to use something entirely, you know, other species to get that point across.
Yeah.
Since some people are like, you know, there's so much otherness when it comes to thinking about, you know, things happening in other countries.
Yeah.
I think about Life of Pi and how the entire time in the book Life of Pi, the boy is on a boat, right? With animals, a zebra, a tiger. And, the entire time he's trying to figure out how to survive on this boat with these animals that are like this one tiger that just wants to kill him. And then at the very end of the book, it's revealed somewhat that it was actually a murderous like chef or something. I can't remember that was on the boat with him. He just used a tiger as a way of coping. Yeah. And by the time you walk away from it, you realize that it was actually an incredibly traumatizing experience with people on the boat and people are hungry, wanting to murder each other, and his amazing ability to survive. And then that kind of hits you. Maybe it's easier to swallow when you think it's a tiger, but the symbolism is really strong.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, that Life of Pi. Mm. Big, big fan of it. So I think we've kind of covered that, the epic fantasy quest there. And I hope everyone listening at home has found it useful. I wanted to ask you your thoughts on this research that I did probably a couple of years ago now and the results, and see if you agree, basically.
Okay.
So what do you think the top result was? This is the least favorite trope.
Oh, the least favorite trope. The
most overdone, I suppose.
The one that I hear from everybody is the chosen one.
Yeah, spot on there.
Is that the one?
Yeah, it got the most votes. 10% of the votes overall. It was also where there's the orphan child with super duper powers. Basically the chosen one, yeah.
You mean Harry Potter? Is that what
basically
we're talking about?
It's just any kind of sort of chosen figure, isn't it? It's just like really common in fantasy, and it's like a default for a lot of people. Like they seem to just start with like a chosen one trope, and that's what the story's going to be about. I don't know. But yeah, so what did you think? You completely agree with that?
I think the chosen one trope is rooted in a lot of history.
Yeah.
And I unpacked this with Lucy McLaren on my podcast, another writer, and we talked about that. We talked about how it's prevalent in like histories, mythologies. I mean, even real life people can apply themselves to the chosen one trope. Think of King Henry VIII, who thought that God spoke directly to him, and therefore he had the ability to change up the church and marry and behead as many wives as he wants. I think he only beheaded two of them, but anyway, so I think that the chosen one trope comes from a place of truth. It's how you work with it to make it fresh. I think for middle grade children, Chosen One is a really good introductory for them because it kind of builds in self-interest.
Yeah.
But you eventually, though, you want to move past that and create more complexities for your story. So I think the Chosen One can become a pitfall if you create a too powerful main character. And it's just a matter of like, how do you combine the idea of a main character who has a destiny to do something with other plot devices so it doesn't come off as too predictable and done, I guess you
could say. Nice. Completely agree. So what did you think came second?
The best guess is what I personally get kind of tired of. It's when the authoritative organization that you trusted actually was the enemy.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
But just because I've been seeing it everywhere. It's everywhere. Anytime there's like a really strong authoritative figure and you trust them, I'm like, nope, they're going to come out as the end. And sure enough, it happened, you know, with Captain America and S.H.I.E.L.D. being actually Hydra. You know, that's a classic example I like to use.
Yeah. Nice. It was actually evil villains because they're just evil. There's no reason.
Oh, yeah.
And I suppose with older fantasy, it's quite common. Not as much with newer fantasy, I don't find. But depends what you've been reading, I suppose. But that because came.
I guess it's not interesting, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's the point?
Yeah.
So that was very close behind the first one. And God, I'll just ask you one more. What do you think the third least favorite trope was?
Love triangles.
It's related to that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sort of. I'm guessing there is a romantic element to this. Oh. It's women who always need saving.
Oh, the damsel in distress.
Yeah, it's a big problem, especially in like older fantasy. I always remember reading A Wizard's First Rule by, is it Terry Goodkind? I can't even remember now. Wizard's First Rule is the book anyway. I read like 350 pages of it and gave up because you had this character, this female character. I can't remember her name now. Have you read it?
I know, I haven't read that one.
No, just in case you knew the names of the characters. But yeah, there's this female character who basically arrives on the scene and meets this other character, the main character called Richard. And Richard's a bit of a chosen one. He doesn't know it at the time. But this female character is really sort of, she's got loads of powers and she's quite intriguing. But she just takes a complete backseat in the whole story and just becomes an object that Richard has to save and protect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so tiring. It's like, Jesus Christ, she's like a person, you know what I mean? Like, she can do things on her own. Like, she found Richard on her own in the first place. Why is she all of a sudden like completely unable to do anything? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And I really don't like that is one of my most hated tropes.
I've been grateful that Disney's turned tail on that trope because I mean that was their lean in for many, many years. But now you have characters like Moana who is now saving the day on her own and there's no love interest required.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like it's a mark of the time and also a projection of maybe the writer's biases because I think a lot about how back in the olden days, which isn't actually that old, but women, I'm speaking from my knowledge in America, but women couldn't, you know, take out a loan, you know, on their own. And they were entirely dependent on their husband. So key things in their life, like who they marry and such, it was a huge indicator of like what their life changes were going to be. And then you see that kind of reflected in Snow White can't really do anything about this apple until the prince kisses her. You know, the idea that your life is saved when a male character chooses to have a romantic, you know, interest in you, which kind of reflects you moving out of your parents' house to then move right into your spouse's house and that lack of agency as set by systemic oppression. And what I love about moving away from this trope is that it reflects that we are able to do that in the real world too. Or at least I hope so. I know that that's not the case worldwide or, you know, across all cultures, but just having the ability as a woman to be able to make decisions and systemically be supported. Like, I can take out a bank loan. I could buy my own house. The fact that that is there supports the ability for a woman to have her independence.
Exactly. And these are the kind of things that I love to discuss in stories. And I'm guessing you do anything like this as well? Like, you use these like sort of big issues in society and try and sort of tackle them in your stories as well?
Yeah. So my stories have a lot to do specifically with cultural identity and intergenerational trauma. And my first manuscript is about a mother and a daughter who are going through an absolutely ridiculous situation. They're surviving an alien invasion. And the mother is a very strict, conservative Vietnamese woman, immigrant woman. And the daughter is your half-race, Americanized, raised woman, woman. And showing that intergenerational, interaction faced against an absolutely ridiculous, humorous sci-fi scenario. And I wanted that challenge because I felt like those stories were always kind of rooted in like literary fiction or women's fiction. Yeah. And it's important for me to have a woman's voice in the sci-fi realm. And that's actually been one of the hardest things I've realized I've come across. My agent told me when she first signed on with me that it's either going to be a really great sell because it's a great book, or we're going to come across some of those set limits, I guess, where there's just not a whole lot of women voices in sci-fi. And I'm really hoping to fix that.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed. Some of the best writers of sci-fi are women. So it makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
And so there's a couple of tropes that I wanted to ask you about in particular. Okay. And one of them was resurrections, or the deaths that are sort of suggested or implied, and then turns out it was just a load of rubbish.
Yes.
And another was mentor figures. So what do you think about these two?
Okay, so I have notes on the resurrection one because I'm actually planning something with it. Let me just find it real quick.
Very cool. Okay.
So the thing about resurrections is it doesn't have to be limited to just literally what we think of with the resurrection, like Jesus resurrecting after so many days in a cave. Resurrection is actually just, it shows up all the time in history. There's tons of mythological figures that have resurrected. Even the act of the sun coming up and setting and then overnight coming back again, that's considered resurrection. And you think of the cyclical nature of mythology and religions, it's just really prominent. And then at the same time, you have resurrection in certain character archetypes like vampires and zombies. And it's almost like an interesting way of saying you rose wrong. like whoops, that wasn't right, kind of thing, versus like the all-powerful being. But either way, it seems like no matter how you rise, you're a super version of what you were before.
Yeah.
And so I like that. It's resurrection in general is supposed to symbolize hope and rebirth, but that same exact idea being inverted to actually create fear, like when the vampire comes up through the grave, you know, I thought that was really interesting. And then not only that, but if you've seen, this happens so many times, but the most recent example in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, you have Wong flying over the edge of a cliff and maybe he's dead. And then later on he pops back up and he's perfectly fine. His character essentially is resurrected, not for because that's the point, but because that's more done for thrills and like a fake out. That happens all the time, but usually though, when a character resurrects like that, it comes with hope, right? It's supposed to make you feel a certain way. Inversely, if the villain you thought died comes back, now you have a whole new level of fear. So I like how resurrection can be used as both a high and a low point.
What do you think writers should avoid then when the experiment with that trope?
With resurrections, let's see.
Because it can be done quite badly, can it?
Yeah, I think if you overdo the surprise, they never die. Like when people start to dissect a story and they're like, but you never did see the body though. Yeah. You know, when Wanda got crushed by that temple, we didn't actually see her guts splattered everywhere. So therefore she can definitely come back, you know. I think The Chosen One resurrects. So now we're getting into the trope everyone hates. I actually did not like it when Neo got shot up in the hallway and then came back to life when Trinity kissed him.
Yeah.
I thought that wasn't I was like, like, I mean, I got the point and I appreciated it, but I was also like, that felt a little cheesy. So I think watching the delivery, I think one way I liked it was when Jon Snow, was killed in Game of Thrones, and my memory's fading on this one, but how he was dead and then he gets resurrected. But some people had so many theories on how he would resurrect, and I don't actually remember how he resurrected now.
Wasn't it Melisandre?
Oh yeah, it was her. Which that, then I remember people were like, oh, because that some people thought the direwolf was gonna like exchange souls, yeah, or something like that. So you know,
that's I think I quite like that about Melisandre as well. I really like George R. R. Martin's storytelling, and it's, mm-hmm, I say quite a lot of influence in my own, in that like different characters. Well, I always feel with George R. R. Martin, there's like some kind of higher force, like the sort of gods or whatever, mm-hmm, playing a game.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I kind of feel that certain characters have purposes. And these characters are obviously searching for that purpose. Well, some of them are. But obviously, Melisandre, she got it wrong quite a lot. But she was of the belief that her purpose was something greater, like, mm-hmm, looking after the, what should we call it, Stannis Baratheon, the Lord of Lights that she thought he was or whatever.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But her real purpose...
She found out it was John or something?
Yeah, well, her real purpose was just to bring Jon Snow back to life, wasn't it?
That's
that
right.
Was,
yes.
And then after that, she literally just melted into the nothingness. Like, that was, mm-hmm, that was the sole purpose of her being. And she lived, what, God, we don't really know much about, because it's not, we need the books for that, them answers, but what she was, because she was just a sort of shape-shifting person, like a bit of a witch, mm-hmm, kind of sorceress kind of figure.
Yeah.
But yeah. I found it really like fascinating that seemed to be her purpose, but she didn't know it until the time came, and she'd been pursuing all these other goals and objectives that she thought was right, mm-hmm, and she was wrong. And it was only, yeah, when fate puts it before you,
yeah,
that, yeah, you understand. Like, I thought that was quite clever. I don't know.
It's like, yeah, the chessboard, right? He put all his pieces where he needed them to be, and you can't tell. And then suddenly he makes a move, and you realize it was all orchestrated.
Yeah. It's fantastic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the other trope I wanted to ask you about was the mentor figure.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the mentor figure trope.
The last time I talked about the mentor figure for my podcast, we were talking about how they're always dying.
Yeah.
Because it seems like the chosen one can only move on when his mentor has died.
Yeah. Or where they only reveal a snippet of information.
And it's
yeah.
Like Dumbledore, who only releases a little bit at a time, just enough to get these kids in trouble.
Yeah, and Gandalf, who just speaks in riddles and then is killed by a demon.
It was not very helpful.
Yeah. Well,
that's like the people, you know, when you go to your parents and you're like, hey, how do you spell water? And they're like, look it up. I'm like, or you can just tell me how to spell water and we want you to learn how to look it up. I'm like, but I'll never forget how to spell water if you just told me how water was spelled. Like,
yeah,
that's an example.
I think that's the problem. It's like, I get from a storytelling perspective why Gandalf only reveals snippets of information in riddles, because it'd be boring. Gandalf just turned around and was like, told you everything that you needed to know, then the story's done. But at the same time, it jars, because you know that he knows, but he's not telling for some reason that isn't true to the story. He's not telling us. Mm-hmm. So I always feel like it's not relatable, because in reality, you would find out, wouldn't you? But if that person knew, they would tell you.
Yeah. I think what's more realistic is a mentor that isn't actually out for you, but they're for themselves. You come across that a lot sometimes, like when you're starting out new in the world and you have like the rose colored glasses and you have this great outlook on everybody, and you don't realize that everyone's actions are informed by whatever it is that they're doing, whatever their self-interest may be, altruistic or not. And there can be really great mentors who, you know, are teachers. I feel like I had a lot more mentors when I was a kid and there was an actual structure for teachers. But once you go out into the real world, you start finding that they're like, not all mentors are created the same. And some mentors might actually have bad intentions, whether it's, you know, they're like, they see value in you, a hard worker, and like, I can put that person to use for my needs.
Yeah. I think The Lies of Locke and Lamora, if you've ever read that, that's got a few good crooked mentor figures in it.
Do you like crooked mentors then?
Yeah, I just like things that try and make the trope a bit different. It's not just sort of some beardy old man.
Yeah.
Spilling the gospel. Yeah, I also like an absence of mentor figures, because obviously we learn, like, humans learn in all different kind of ways, but from observing other people do things, and I suppose we don't need one sole figure to learn something. Like a character who's the classic orphan, for example, the chances of them getting taken under the wing of someone and that sort of educated on everything, it's unlikely that they're going to learn from observing other interactions with people. Like, there might be like an older child who manages to get more food than the others, and he sort of watches and observes that and then tries it himself. Like, there's lessons can be learned all over the place. And I think it's a bit of a cop-out just to have one figure that has all the information.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if a way to kind of play with that then in a contemporary novel is the mentor figure is actually a random self-help book that you found off of like a Goodwill shelf.
Yeah.
And you perceive it to be like a know-all resource. But then what would be really interesting is as you encounter your own life's experiences, challenging what comes up in that self-help book, because self-help books are, you know, they come with context and certain perspectives and bias. And it's just an easy way to visually represent one know-all source.
Yeah.
And maybe you lost the book halfway through the epic journey or it got burned in a fireplace.
I just think of all the misguided books about dating women.
I see a lot of people rising to like giving you advice on like career success, but when I listen to it, it's a lot of like, you gotta just want what you want, you just gotta do it.
Speaking in cliches.
Thanks.
It's just a lot of inspirational quotes and cliches, there's no substance to it. Like that's the age we live in though, that people do buy into that sort of superficial advice. I kind of feel like that's something that we could play on as well. Involves all these sort of the lack of trustworthiness of a mentor figure. And like you say, there are characters who have come across as mentors and then shocked us all at the end.
Yep.
I think they kind of flirted with that in the Lord of the Rings, the new Lord of the Rings series. I won't say anything because it's spoilers, but if you have seen it, you might know what I mean. Oh, well, it's been absolutely lovely chatting with you, Vicky. Thank you very much for giving up your time. How can we find out a bit more about you if anyone out there would like to check your podcast out or your website or your writing?
So you can find anything about me if you go to vickylawn.com, which I'm sure will probably be in the notes, but for the sake of here, it's V-I-C-K-I-E and then L-A-N .com. So there you're going to find some old blog posts, you'll see my manuscripts, you'll see my podcast itself. And then if you want to find my podcast, I'm pretty much on every streaming platform. You can also look up Speculative Sandbox and you'll get the like Apple Podcasts or Spotify and the like. But yeah, my main goal of my podcast was to have those, you sit down and you really talk about, and you workshop something in your story.
Yeah.
And I, you know, look forward to more listeners if you guys like that stuff. And of course, I'm always welcoming new guests.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I'll make sure you're on there if you love me. And if you'd like to come back, I'd be thrilled to have you back as well. Maybe we can talk about approaches to workshopping ideas and stories. So that'd be really helpful. Give some advice on that.
Yeah, let's do it.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you very much again. And thank you very much, everyone at home, for listening. A big thank you, Vicky, for giving up your time to chat with me. It was a really interesting discussion. I hope you enjoyed it at home. I hope you learned something new. Hope it gave you some new ideas, maybe. If you enjoyed it, please do consider following us, subscribing, or giving us a quick rating on the Spotify mobile app. I don't know why you can't do it on desktops, but for some reason, mobile is the one. But yeah, a rating does go a long way, and it's really appreciated, as is a share. So if you enjoyed the episode, you think someone else might be interested, please do share it with them or share it on social media. That is really helpful. We do this purely for the love of it, so a share goes a long way. And don't forget, if you want to join a critique group, click the link in the description to join. We've got like 7 or 8 groups now, so there's going to be more. We're just going to keep growing and growing and growing. So if you want to join a critique group that meets up every 2, 3, 4 weeks, head on over, join us. And again, I just wanted to say a big thank you for listening to the show this year. If this is your first episode, thank you very much. If you listen to every episode this year, thank you again. I really do find it amazing that people can stand listening to me for 30 plus minutes sometimes, but I do constantly aim to make it as helpful as possible. It has been a brilliant year, and I am really grateful to everyone who's listened. The reason why I do these episodes and invite people on the show is purely to help fellow writers with ideas, research, inspiration. And I am grateful because this year, the results, like I found out on Spotify, that the podcast is it's in the top 5% podcasts in the world for like, most shared and the most followed as well. And that blows me away. Like apparently people in 89 different countries listen to this podcast. Again, that blows me away. So it's amazing. Thank you so much. And here's to an even bigger and better next year.